Welcome back to the FKT Podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today, I'm joined by Justin Jennings and Hugh Rogers. Together with three others, Cy Lewis, Darren Roberts, and Jamie Porter, they completed Papua New Guinea's 100-kilometer Kokoda Trek out and back in an astonishing 8 days round trip. Hugh and Justin, thank you guys so much for coming on the show today to talk about this really unique FKT.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yeah, really excited.
So I want to start out, first of all, I'm sure I'm not the only one. Most of our listeners probably have no idea what the, is. Maybe I'm not even saying this right, Kokoda Trail, what that is, where that is. Could you just start out by telling us about the track itself?
Before Jay jumps in, I won't lie to you. I didn't know much about it before Jay suggested it, so it was completely news to me. And when he suggested it and he gave the history, which I'm sure he will shortly, it was a completely sort of new thing to me as well, if I'm honest.
Well, yeah, probably new to many people, and we're kind of serial offenders on these kind of slightly off the beaten track tours. We've done a couple of things. We took a stretcher. Or like a litter, you know, like I think you call it in America, mm-hmm. a litter. We carried a litter across a tough mudder. We then took that a bit further forward and carried a litter with a 100-kilogram dummy on it from the Armistice Memorial in France through to Abergavenny in Wales over 11 days. And then we did a couple of other things. We did the Pyrenees, which Hugh might give you a bit more detail on. And so we've kind of done roads. We've done mountains, and then we thought, let's find something different. A friend of mine mentioned the Kokoda Track, which is a World War II area of battle in Papua New Guinea that's extremely significant to the Australians. Australians' kind of national identity is built around Gallipoli, but that was them fighting for a set of other people, for the Allies, whereas Papua New Guinea, they were fighting for Australians, Australian nationals on Australian territory. And it was basically around a Japanese intended invasion, potentially of Australian mainland, 10,000 force of Australians coming down from a village called Kokoda in Papua New Guinea towards the southernmost port of Port Moresby. So it's just short of 100-kilometer track through dense jungle on a volcano, basically. Extremely humid, horrendous conditions. And the Japanese fought down the track, but were repelled by a small militia force, essentially, of Australian soldiers, helped out massively by Papua New Guinean fighters and Papua New Guinean locals who helped with casualty evacuation and stuff. So it's an enormous thing that Australians go and commemorate every year to this day. It's a massive part of Australian national identity. And they will typically take somewhere between 8 to 11 days to kind of meander and bimble up this track. So we thought, that's great. It's challenging environmentally. It's got historical relevance to us, you know, particularly because three of our team of five were military and still are. So it seemed to have all the hooks for us emotionally to do the challenge, all the right toughness, level of difficulty. And that's why we kind of chose it. It was something different from what we've done before.
And different it was, Jay, wasn't it? It was different.
And it was different.
Yeah, it was different.
Yeah. And Hugh, as you said, you didn't really know much about this. And so when Justin says, hey, do you want to go do this, you know, hellacious trek through the jungle, you were just like, yeah, that sounds great.
Do you know how it started was, so Jay has been raising funds for the mountain rescue team that I'm in for quite a long time. I work in the outdoor industry as a trip leader, and I had a trip in June a few years prior to that, and the trip got cancelled, and short notice, literally on the mountain rescue sort of team chat, somebody came through and they said, we need somebody to go to the Pyrenees to do a trip with some of these boys. And you know, I did know they were, and I had met Jay and a few of the others before. And they were literally like, it's going to be a really tough trip across the Pyrenees. It's called the Freedom Trail. So it's normally done in however many days, but you're going to do double the distance over the mountain. And you're going to do it in half the time there and back. And I remember sat on my sofa thinking, I've never met these boys before, you know, properly. And I thought, well, you know, let's give it a go. And I did that, and what a trip that was. That was pretty brutal. And, you know, like with all these trips, I sort of laugh at myself a little bit. And my wife, you know, she always says I'm really guilty for it, is where you say you'll never, ever do this ever again. And halfway through that Pyrenees trip, day three, I think we were all absolutely hanging.
That was tough.
And I was saying, what has he got? What have I done? What have I got myself into? And then we got back, we had some food. We relaxed a bit, and then literally 2 months later, we had a sort of celebration dinner in London. And Jay said, right, I've got a plan. I've got to check it out, but would you be willing to go to the jungle of Papua New Guinea? And I remember probably like a bottle of wine in going, yeah, count me in. I'm in. I've done it. And then I woke up in the morning, I thought I really should check this trip out and see what it was, but it was too late. You know, it was, you know, Jay's got this sort of infectious enthusiasm where, you know, during the trip you want to kill him, but afterwards, you know, you think, yeah, go on, I'm in, I'm 100% in. And it was just like that. It was, yeah, let's give it a go. Boy, did I regret it though.
Got a tactic. There's a rule and a tactic. The rule is that you're in for life. Once you've done one of the events, you know, you are the first person to be asked, and you're not really asked. You it's a non-negotiable.
You've press ganged
into it. And the tactic is to ply them with wine before you ask.
Right, that's a good tactic. I mean, I feel like, you know, that's a good way to get people to join in with your harebrained ideas for sure.
And the underlying premise is doing stuff that's not been done before, but it's got to be perceived by people who know what they're talking about. It's got to be seen as that I'm not sure you can do that. Because when we talked about the Pyrenees, you know, the Pyrenees is usually done as a trek in 5 days from France to Spain. So we decided to go there and back. But when you're telling in the same 5 days, so you tell friends we're going to go there and back in 5 days across the Pyrenees, they can't really comprehend that. Is it difficult? Is that going to be easy? But the people who know what you're talking about say, well, that's ridiculous. And we met the guy who helped us organize it. The guy from Papua New Guinea happened to be in London when I finally met him face to face. Really brilliant guy called Tuller. And he came with us, Tuller and his brother and his girlfriend Hazel. And they did the trip with us. And I said to him, look, I want you to go back to your guides and I want them to say, I don't think you can do that, but not to say, no, you can't do that. If the second they say you can't do that, then we won't do it. When we talked about taking the stretcher across the Pyrenees, our two guides said, you can't do that. So we didn't, you know, we'd accept scientific or technocrat advice, but we want to push the boundaries. And Tala said to us, when I tell my guides that we're going to go there and back in 8 days, they're going to think I'm crazy. I was like, brilliant. That's what we're looking for.
But we needed to know if it's possible though, didn't we? Because we were weighing it up and saying, is this possible to do in those 8 days? You know, are we going to be able to do it? And I think I remember we had a phone call where we were discussing it, and I remember asking the teller, you know, is this possible? And there was a long pause, and he said, it'll be very tough. But it is possible. And I remember sat there, you know, where your heart's racing, and I'm thinking, oh, is this, are we going to kill ourselves trying on this? But
And the guides, I don't know if we've got questions, Heather, but like, we're just kind of.
No, this is great. I think you're covering everything I was going to ask anyway.
So the guides that we had, the kind of the core of the guides we had, like I say, we had five guides, but three of them were brothers, and they were very, very accomplished. They'd done this a lot. But the guy that they kind of brought out of, he came out of retirement because he said, this will be kind of my career crowning glory. Guy called Fred. And he'd done a lot. Well, I don't know what a lot is in terms of this industry, but he'd been doing it for many years. Had retired, And then he came back out of retirement to do this with us because it had never been achieved before, the there and back in 8 days. That also reassured us in the kind of, one, can it be done? But also, is this really the first time? Because we, you know, not probably in the world, nothing's ever the first of anything, but it was the first we could find it recorded. There was no, we checked, we asked the locals, you know, do you know of this being done before in this time? And they all kind of confirmed no. And the fact that he came back out of retirement to do it was the reassurance that it was a unique feat, yeah, really.
I was skeptical before we went, and I thought, oh, there's going to be locals who've done this. And, you know, I was a little bit sort of nervous that we were sort of killing ourselves for something that had been done before. And actually, when we got out there and we chatted to people and we chatted to locals and we chatted to the guides, by the time we left the trail, I was absolutely happy that, it was certainly not a common thing, and we were the first to do it. But we talked about conditions, you know, didn't we? And anyway, I'll leave that for later on. But
So just a little bit of backstory about who was involved here, because obviously you two are joining me on the show today. But there were five of you in total that set out to attempt this, and then your guides. So could you just give me a rundown of who was involved and how they came to be involved? Like, did you just supply a lot of people with wine, Justin, and just like, and get people to agree to do with this, you know, until you had the right number? Like, who did you get involved in how? And then also talk about the guides. You've mentioned, you know, Fred and a couple of the others, but maybe just give us a picture of who all was involved.
It started quite a long time ago when, for whatever reason, you're familiar with Tough Mudder. It's quite, you know, it's big, yes, in the States, mm-hmm, right? So for whatever reason, I thought it'd be a good idea to try and carry a stretcher across a Tough Mudder. But we needed 100 kilograms. I wanted it to represent one of the bigger people that I serve with, you know, so that it's kind of relevant to an actual casualty extraction. If we were in a fight in a war zone somewhere and you had to carry someone out, and let's say they had a bag of kit you couldn't leave behind as well, so we strapped a 100 kilogram dummy from a company called Ruth Lee, who donated us the dummy. Actually, it still sits out the back of my house and postmen get scared by it.
I'm hoping you don't get any more ideas about it, Jay. To be honest,
yeah. it's called Ruth. The dummy's called Ruth, and we always talk about what we're doing with Ruth next. And so we strapped Ruth to a stretcher, to a litter, as well as a 20 kilogram day sack. So it was 120 kilograms plus the litter. And we decided, four of us, to carry it across a Tough Mudder, but keeping it horizontal and treating it like a dummy, not just throwing it over walls, whatever, you know, treating her like it was something that we cared about. Tough Mudder thought we were like crazy as well. But we did it, and it took us 8 hours to do 11 miles. Nearly broke one of the guys' backs. We got all sorts of comments around the way. Anyway, so we did that. So it created a bit of interest. And then I thought, well, let's, and at that point we tied into Brecon Mountain Rescue, because I asked them how, you know, did they have any advice on carriage, on straps, on wheels and stuff? And I got friends with one of the guys there who then, he basically infected Brecon Mountain Rescue team and said, right, you lot are all getting involved in this. And then we then carried it across the southern coast of England, the South Downs way. We carried it for 50 miles, a different bunch of guys. And then we carried it, when we took it from France, we wanted to raise money for Brecon Mountain Rescue, and they gave us five guys to come who carried it with us. So as a team of 20 carrying it, we all walked the, whatever it was, like 193 miles, I think we walked, something like that, from the Armistice Memorial in Compiègne up to the coastline, across underneath London and all the way up to Wales. And that 20-person team, 11 days, 11 marathons. We finished on the 11th of November on the 100th anniversary of Armistice. And then went and did a Remembrance Day service in full kind of dress uniform. So we've got a deep relationship with Brecon Mountain Rescue, and I've got a recruiting pool who I always go to for my next idea. And the guys that came on this one, again, were repeat offenders. Si and Jamie and I are serving military. Hugh will tell you about himself in a second. But Darren, when we did the Pyrenees trip, there was a guy at my work giving a talk about team spirit and motivating elite performers. And he and I hit it off straight away. He gave us a whole lot of clothing to do the Pyrenees in. His part of what he does is he's a part of a company called Volaback, who do like high performance clothing. And he donated us. I met him on a Monday. Wednesday, he asked for our sizes. And Friday, we had thousands of pounds worth of kit to wear over the Pyrenees. Donated. Yeah. And he also said, we invited him to the kind of the post-event thank you meal. And he said, next time you do this, you know, give me a call. I'll come and do it with you. Like I said, in for life. So he, as soon as we come up with Kokoda, I called him, like, you come in. And he said, yeah. And actually he was about to, I'm not sure he won't mind me saying, he's joined the police in the background to this event. And he had to have a real battle with the police over fitness tests. He had a fitness test was timed for around about the time of the event. And we said, I think doing 200K through Papua New Guinean jungle in record time might give you a waiver on the fitness test. And luckily they let him postpone it. They didn't give him a waiver. He postponed it and had to do it when he got back.
Yeah. But you know, he's a dark horse, Daz, because, you know, he's a fit guy, but I didn't realize quite how fit he was until pretty much towards the end of the Kokoda, because he talked a lot about ultra running. And, you know, he was really, really key to sort of teach us things. And he said, oh, I've done a bit of ultra running myself. And then right at the end, on the last day, he said, oh, remember I talked about the Namibia Ultra Marathon? Oh, well, I actually won that. And I said, well, you actually won the Namibia Ultra Marathon? He said, yeah, I didn't want to tell you really, because I thought some of you might get a bit nervous about how quick I could be. So, you know, he's a real fit guy, Daz. And
he was a professional runner for Berghaus magazine, fitness magazine. And he did those three ultras, didn't he? Namibia, Brazil, was it? Oh, no, the Amazon rainforest. He'd done a 200 miler through the Amazon, the 98 miler, I think it was, through Namibia. And he's done the Mont Blanc. What's the Mont Blanc one? Oh, the UTMB. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he's a very established professional.
He didn't calm tell us how good he was, though, I don't think. I think he kept that to himself before, especially until the end on the last day. And, you know, I said, even after all that, how did you find that? And he said, oh, yeah, that was still really tough, which made me feel better as I couldn't walk.
He said that's the hardest thing he's ever done, didn't he?
Yeah, I think, I think he might have said that, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Hugh, sorry, mate, I've totally overrun you. You give your
Yeah, no, that's fine. You can overrun me all you want. Yeah. yeah, it was me. So, I work in the outdoors. So I take groups on trips. I work for a company called Discover Adventure down in Salisbury. I do generally a lot of treks, a lot of paddle sports. I work for a company called With Dave and mountain bike trips. So, you know, it sort of ties in. And for me, I think when we get given these trips, as somebody who takes people on adventures, you're often in your comfort zone when they are completely out of their comfort zone. And what I find is it's really good to make sure that you regularly put yourself outside your comfort zone so you can empathize with how they are feeling. Because, you know, I did a Killy trip 2 weeks ago, and Killy's still a hard, you know, it's a hard trek. But, you know, you'll see people at the most nervous, and you'll say that summit push is, you know, one of the hardest things you'll ever do. And I always, to be brutally honest, I always link back to that midpoint of Papua New Guinea when I'm thinking they're probably feeling how I felt on that midpoint now. So it's really good, working in the outdoor industry to push yourself regularly so you can empathize with people when they're feeling they're most frightened or they're most nervous. So, it's still part of the job, I think. Still part of the job.
Right. So, I know you guys went with a guided company, True Warrior, I believe is what
True Warrior,
I saw
yeah.
online.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like when you're talking about, you know, Hugh being the guide and the clients are outside their comfort zone and sort of thing. It sounds like you kind of flipped the script a little bit on your guides for this, because it sounds like they didn't do the full round trip with you, or at least not all of them did. Can you talk a little bit about what that dynamic was like with the guides and with the group and how that unfolded? Because obviously you're on an extremely aggressive itinerary to try to do this round trip in like the time that most people will do one way.
Yeah. You happy with me? Yeah.
Go on. Yeah. You do this bit, Jay, because I think it was clear for me that, the moment that sticks out, and Jay can add to this, is we were getting our bags weighed at the start. So everybody gets their bags weighed. So the route is that we are used to carrying our own kit. And I think from every trip we've done, we've carried our own kit. So I normally carry clients' kit when they can't carry it. So when we did this, we were told right from an early stage, there will be guides with you. It's a guided route. You don't do it on your own. You will take guides with you, and they will be with you throughout. And they will carry some of your kit. And that was quite a big turning point for us, Jay, because, wasn't it? Because we were not used to people carrying stuff for us. So we discussed it, and I didn't know whether that might be a bit of a deal breaker for Jay, whether it was okay. Personally, I was all right with it because I thought, well, you know, it's going to be horrendous. So I, you know, you got to think up there, you got to think with a brain. And I thought if they want to carry some of the kit, but it didn't sit right with us, if I'm honest. And, you know, right from the outset, we knew that not all of the guides would go all of the way because it just wouldn't be possible. It was, I not to sound big-headed, you know, it was too much of a physical challenge for that bigger group. And we were weighing the bags right at the start. And, you know, I remember our bags were something like 15 kilograms. And then some of the guides' bags who were carrying huge things of tinned food were carrying big bags. Mm-hmm. And it didn't sit right with us. And we said, well, we want to take some of that. And it was made clear, well, they're not going the distance you're going. They're going up to camp to set up for tonight. And then they will go a little bit further on. So it was always made clear to us that a guided route was not an option. It was always going to be a guided route, and there will be people with you who will effectively support you, and that is how it's going to be. And if you're not happy mm-hmm. with that, the trip's not for you. But then as the trip went on, some of the guides did come the whole way with us, and they were, it was a little bit different. I'll let you talk about that, Jay.
Well, I guess when we, like Hugh says, when we spoke to Tuller at the beginning, Tuller, the guy, he's our point of contact with True Warrior. And he's become a family mm-hmm. friend. He's been back to my house since since it's all finished. He's part of the furniture now. But when we initially spoke, I said to him, like Hugh says, that's for me it's a deal breaker. The people are carrying my kit. That's not how we operate. That's not how I live. It's not how we work in the military. Shared effort, but he said, like, it's essentially like going up Everest. You can't go up Everest without a Sherpa. It's how the guys make their money. It's how they make their living. That's their livelihoods. And so to not let them carry your stuff, or to not let them have you'd be disrespecting the way they do things. So we're like, okay, happy compromise. We'll wake it at the beginning, and we'll make sure no one carries any more weight than anyone else. Let's do it like that. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of the deal we came to. It turns out they chinned that off totally and carried more, but made us feel like we were all doing the same. mm-hmm. So that was, we had to accept that that's their livelihood. We're going through their villages. Actually, Fred, we went through Fred's and Gibson's village that they live in, they come from. That was part of the trek. And that was in itself a real honor to come through and see their home, see their kids. That was a brilliant part. That's probably one of the highlights. But yeah, so I guess from, and it's worth saying at this point, we had no idea what FKT, I certainly didn't know what FKT was. So if you were trying to, in terms of FKT, this is almost impossible to run this as a unsupported, I would say, because the Kokoda track has an authority that has mm-hmm. a set of rules that says you must go through with guides. It doesn't say anything about what you can or can't carry, other than you can't carry more than 15 kilograms. So they have mm-hmm. there are rules on that track which would have an impact on how you'd fit into FKT. But like I say, we didn't know that at that time. And so we all set off with the limit of no more than 15 kilograms, which dictated the amount of clothing, how we'd, you know, how we'd sleep at night, the risk of mosquitoes and that kind of stuff, and nutrition, which, yeah, we might want to talk about later on. But yeah, so the guides, we had a kind of the core five who took us and set the pace. And it turns out we're cooking us breakfast and cooking meals at night. And if we were to ever change things, we try to relieve them of that duty. And then there was a kind of an outer core who also did the logistical moves. So with a normal trek, they would set the trekkers off in the morning. They'd zoom past them by their own routes mm-hmm. and get to the next camp and prepare that group coming in. But because we mm-hmm. were traveling not massively faster, but twice as long every day, we were going for 12, 13 hours every day. Their logistic chain couldn't keep up with us. They weren't mm-hmm. expecting us to move so fast and so long every day repeatedly. And they couldn't keep up with the log chain. So that's why they struggled, really. It was out of their expectation as well. They'd never done it like that before.
So it was a tactic mm-hmm. change as well, Jay, wasn't it? There was a big tactic change. I think they realized on day one that perhaps the plan that they'd made as a sort of company wasn't particularly going to work that well. And the plan changed, and it was, you know, we were all in it together. You know, we talk about teams, we were in it together as a team. So we were, you know, we were just going with the flow and seeing how it went. What could we do to help? Yeah. And it evolved over the 10 days.
So we had to get, what we knew was we had to get to the turnaround point by day four.
8 days. Sorry. 8 days.
Because to get back in 8 days, you had to make that. There was a bit of negotiation. We kind of have a brief in the morning or a brief at night, what we're going to do the next day and talk that through with the guides. And they would work out amongst themselves who was going to set the pace. Hazel took us up on the first day, didn't she? And then, but from there on in, it became the kind of core Fred who, as I say, came out of retirement. He became known as 2 minutes Fred because he'd sort of say, right up there, we're going to have a 2 minute break. And I think their time appreciation was different to ours. So we are military thinkers, mountain rescue thinkers. We're like, okay, how long's the next leg going to take? How far do you think we're going to go in that? And they would typically look at their watch and then say, oh, about an hour. It's about an hour to the next stop. And it was never an hour to the next stop. It was often 3 hours or more, and a lot of more inclination than they'd you know, given us, because I think they never, when they do it normally, they just know, oh, well, I'm going to be at this checkpoint by the end of today, because that's how it always works. But we blew all that out of the water for them. Yeah.
I think by day one, there was a lot of realizations happening to me in terms of logistics, pace, the team, because on day one, we'd not covered enough ground. And because I studied the plan quite intensively, because that's just my nature, I knew at the end of day one we'd not covered enough ground, and it was probably a completely sleepless night because I was led in this sort of mosquito net, wide awake with the other boys in this sort of hat, and I was thinking, we've not covered anywhere near enough ground. And you know what you take from today, you take on tomorrow. And I knew that we had a huge day then the next day, because we'd not covered even nearly enough. And I think that was the bedding in period. And if I could go and speak to myself now at that sort of within that mosquito net, sort of fretting and worrying and thinking, you know, it'll be all right. You know, you can make it. You can do more tomorrow. You'll be strong enough. But then you're worrying, thinking, you know, we've just not done it. And the plan did change that rapidly, where I thought we've got to be doing further than this. And it worked out fine, but you don't know it at sort of 3 o'clock in the morning when you're wide awake and not sleeping and thinking, wow, we're going to have a huge day tomorrow. It's going to be absolutely huge. And, and you know, the ground as well, Kate, sorry if I'm jumping ahead, but the ground totally took me by surprise, where you just couldn't get any traction, and it was all up or it was all down. So the minute you wanted to move fast, you couldn't, because you just slipped down. And I made a few mistakes, which I'll talk about later. But kit choice, there was a few big errors, I think, that if I'd known about the sort of the terrain, I would have done differently. But you just couldn't get any traction, either going up or coming down. And it just slowed you down. It, you know, it made you go half the speed that you could normally go at. And the terrain was, the impact of the terrain, the shorter days, the logistics really dawned on me after day one. And I thought, wow, this is going to be very different to how I planned it in my head.
Mm-hmm. So to build off of that, you know, you have guides, and I mean, I've climbed Kilimanjaro, so this sounds very familiar to me, where they go ahead and they establish camp for you, and there's this leapfrogging effect. So, but you are also carrying some of your own gear, and, you know, Justin, you mentioned fueling. So kind of like, how did these logistics look? So obviously you said a lot of things just changed over the course of the thing, but were you sleeping in tents? Obviously you've mentioned mosquito net. Did you end up, you know, what were your camps like each night? You mentioned they were preparing food at some point, but how did the food play out? Like, were you supplementing with your own food? Yeah, just kind of how did the logistics end up looking?
I think what the plan was, and again, my background in working on organized trips really messed up my plan, because I relied on the food a little bit, the food that was going to be provided a little bit too much. And, you know, we were going, you know, Jay said, I think when some of the longest days, we were sort of 17, 18 hour days where you'd literally stop, you know, get a head down for a bit. And then, so the calorie that we were burning were absolutely ginormous. And I probably hadn't factored that in. And I think at the end of day one, I realized that perhaps the food situation was going to be a little bit different. But the plan is that people's carrying sort of would leapfrog forward, set up a food stop. We would stop for food and then we would get going, and then they would sort of not overtake us, but maybe take a different route, different way around to get ahead of us. But, you know, not to sound big-headed, it just couldn't really happen, that, you know, that the people couldn't get ahead of us. Yeah, it just, by the end of the first day, I think we were having a slight realization that there was no way of getting ahead. It was going to be all together with as much light sort of kit as we possibly could carry. I made a mistake, you know, and I got called out on it, rightly so, that I didn't take enough excess. And I took a fair bit, but I'd realized probably sort of 4 days in that I didn't have enough excess calories to cover all the calories. I mean, I come back lovely and thin. I was a stone lighter by the time I got back, but ultimately, I just couldn't get the calories in from the sort of, it was fast, that fast and light mentality, where perhaps coming from a, you know, a trip leader background, you are used to nice, big, high calorie meals. And I kind of wrongly assumed that we were going to get these sort of hugely densely calorie packed meals, and it just couldn't happen because of the speed we were going and the logistics of the trip. And I would definitely go back. But we got supplied by a company called Radix, who the nutrition was fantastic. It was to supplement those calories. But, you know, we were totally under the illusion that we were all doing this, including us and True Warrior, as a completely new thing. So it was no sort of, you know, we weren't angry or fed up or anything. It was just a case of, look, we're all trying our best in this situation. Mm-hmm. But I underestimated the ginormous 8 days worth of calories that we'd actually be getting through.
I think definitely. Daz used a calculator that kind of professionals used, and it said you need to, according to the elevation, according to the time and the temperature and humidity, you'd need about 12,000 calories a day. And we're like, okay, that's never going to happen. So we knew from the outset we'd be in calorie deficit, but the plan was that essentially they would give us huts to sleep in at night, so we didn't need to carry tents.
Okay.
So the villages have huts which are specifically for visitors. You don't go into the village accommodation. There are huts on the outside of the villages that are for the tourist industry that comes through on this trek. So you're always going to go into a wooden hut with like bamboo kind of slatted flooring, but you're going to be indoors. So we had no tents, but we did take mosquito nets. And they would provide us 3 meals a day. So if you were to do this normally, you wouldn't need to take your own food. Happy to take your own snacks if you want to, but you don't have to. But we knew we were going to be, you know, pushing the limits. So we wanted to carry our own nutrition. So if we just done it normally, they give us somewhere to sleep each night. They tell us where that's going to be. They organize it. and they plan their legs according to your pace. And then you'd have a breakfast that they cook for you, which was typically some kind of porridge with bits of fruit and crackers. Crackers was a staple diet, like dry crackers.
Oh, yeah. So many crackers. I could have turned into a cracker by the end of it.
They walked up hills for 4 hours on a cracker. It's ridiculous. But so you'd have a porridge breakfast, oatmeal breakfast kind of thing. And then you'd have a lunchy kind of snack of noodles or homemade pizzas or something they'd concoct in the village, or some biscuits. And then at the end of the night, you'd get a meal that they all cooked for you. So under normal circumstances, breakfast cooked at the place you're staying, cooked for you when you wake up already there, nice, warm, and a cup of tea. Then a lunch on the move, and then a meal at the end of the day. But like Hugh says, we knew that was never going to be enough. So we fortunately, through Jamie, had a mate in New Zealand, because Jamie lives in New Zealand. Jamie had a mate there who's a British guy and now lives out there, who owns this company called Radix, high performance, freeze-dried nutritional food rather than powders, freeze-dried. And that made all the difference. We probably couldn't have done it without that, because there just wasn't enough nutrition in the True Warrior food for doing it at our pace. And we also had, it's an electrolyte concentrate by a company called Elite Water. And that, again, in 8 days of deeply humid, you know, just there was not a single cramp. I didn't have a single cramp the entire time. And I think Elite Water was a big part of that. And Daz had used those in the Amazon, so he knew it worked for him. So we
biggest,
had...
The biggest loss of life on Kokoda is hyponatremia, which is the sort of not taking on enough salts. And we were really aware of that, is that you've got to top up the salt level. So we were literally... It was a bit of a lifesaver for us, where if you hadn't put some in your drink, you could just even sort of squirt it on your tongue. And and we were really conscious of the risk of the loss of those salts. But yeah,
you know, there was no shortage of water, was there? Obviously, that's the one thing you have got there. Rivers galore. The guides just dip their cup in and drink it. We had filters, didn't we? Like filter cups, filter pumps that were brilliant, that will turn your Coke unfizzy and white. They get rid of everything. They're amazing. Yeah.
Coca-Cola.
So you've touched on a couple of things I'd like to hear more about. One is the temperature and the climate, because all I know is this must have been very hot and very humid. So if you could talk a little bit about, you know, the weather and how that played a factor in this, like what was that like? Because I feel like just saying it was hot and humid is probably an understatement.
So I can tell you that if this had, there's a reason we ran this as a civilian event, is because the army would never in a million years have signed it off. I expect that's reflected in a civilian kind of risk assessment. But the temperatures and the humidity, more so that humidity probably, but the bunch of us traveled. For example, I traveled out on the Monday, arrived on the Tuesday afternoon, and on the Wednesday morning we set off. It's along those, it's that kind of timeline
where there's no Sunday, acclimatization was there, really.
So we had zero acclimatization and went straight into whatever the percentage humidity was. And temperatures, Hugh, what were they?
32 or 33 sort of
Celsius.
But it wasn't that heat. Celsius. It wasn't that heat though, was it? It was just the fact that within 10 minutes, I had a shirt on that was a Volleyback shirt, and it was fabulous, but it was like it had been dipped in a swimming pool and then put back on me for the entire time, to the point where it wasn't dry. And we'll talk about our feet in a sec, but the shirt wasn't dry once in the whole 8 days. It was just like wearing a soaking wet sort of flannel, effectively, in terms of wetness. But it kept you cool. And it was, you know, nothing, you can't prepare for it in the UK. You know, in the UK, it's wet, it's cold, it's grim, but there's nothing like that. So you're hit with a wall of it, and, you know, it just takes every bit of energy out from under your feet, really.
And we did talk about doing joint training, didn't we? At work, me and Si had two watt bikes in the on the side of this, the work swimming pool. We have a swimming pool on our camp, a swimming pool in our camp. And that was the hottest, most humid environment we could find. We had two watt bikes on there, and probably three times or four times we went on those bikes and did like a 40 minute cycle. And then, but life gets in the way, family, and we just didn't do the preparatory training. And like I say, I couldn't get it signed off as a military exercise because they require a much more programmatic, you know, incremental build up to these things. So we just accepted we could never achieve that and did it as a civilian event.
It's just like anything on these sort of events, though, is that anybody who does these sort of things, and they've got the ability just to sort of shut off from the sort of pain, you know, get your head down and just think, this will end one day. It will end when it ends. And that's what it was a bit like, really. And, you know, we talk about, it was funny because I was chatting to the boys about fun moments, and the message stream was just blank when we talked about fun. And it was fun in a way, but there was, you know, we realized quite quickly, you know, that the humidity and the heat was absolutely overbearing, and the mud and the incline and the sort of the steep, slippery slopes. It was either up or down. It was never flat. In fact, the only 5K of flatness was a swamp where you are literally in a swamp. And I was thinking, you know, normally you think, oh, this will end. And then you say, oh, this will end soon. Like a lot of people on your show, you know, listen to a lot of people say that sort of thing, that, you know, you just get your head down, you sort of grizz it out a little bit. But, you know, that it's all those factors together. It's just, you know, it's just how long can you go on for? And it was, it did get a little bit like that. I'd say even by halfway through day two, my head was down and I was thinking, right, you've just got to get this done. You've just got to cope mm-hmm. with this heat, this humidity, this mud. The fact that we're slipping and flying down these slopes every 2 minutes, which of course we'd all turn around and laugh at each other once we sort of dusted each other off. But it was, you know... It was, and
somebody else's misery.
Schadenfreude.
Yeah.
You know, there was one point, and it was literally like I'd been rolled in mud, like a sort of a sausage shape rolled in mud, because I got up and there was nothing clothing wise left of me, just like a pile of mud. And it sort of dried, sort of dripped off me as the day went on. But it was, you know, it was that sort of, right, we just get it done, get to the end of today, and then we will rest and then we'll hit tomorrow. And, you know, and it was a little bit like that, but the heat, the humidity, it just takes every bit of energy out of you, which we couldn't prepare for. You know, I am used to rain. Jay's used to rain. You know, we deal in rain. We deal in cold, miserable rain all the time. So I could grizz that out for you know, years really, because I'm used to standing in it. But the heat, humidity, I just couldn't prep for it really. And that hit me, and that realization hit me quite hard, quite early on.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the only flat was through a swamp, and I saw some pictures, and I really would like to know, is the swamp where you picked up whatever happened to your feet? Like, can you just tell me about what happened to your feet?
the feet, I think with hindsight, we'd say it was trench foot.
Okay.
At the time we did it because we're pretty proud of how we manage our bodies. What we are good at is management, you know, administration, get into your camp at night, sort your feet out first and foremost, sort your kit out. so we managed it pretty well. And then on the fourth day, which is the kind of the downhill to the, what would be the finish for a normal trek. The fourth day, me and Si both kind of had this kind of tingling feeling in our feet, which I thought felt like a beginning of a hot spot. And I kind of attributed that to, we'd taken our boots off and I'd kind of put my feet in a bit of mud, dry mud, as a kind of comforter, put my boots back on, thought I'd cleaned them off, and then developing this hot spot, thought, oh, that was stupid. I must have done something wrong there. By the time we got down to the turnaround point, which was felt like the longest day by far at that point, it is a real challenge to get into Kokoda village, where normally people would be like dropping their day sacks and that's us done. And we know we've got to turn around and go back again. And we checked our feet, and I had these kind of little blisters, little looked like just a small rash of blisters, felt like a rash. And size feet were considerably worse, but exactly the same thing. And we started kind of trying to work out what might have happened and thought, is it spider bites? Is it, have we picked up a kind of infection somewhere? It was peculiar. We both got it the same day. It looked exactly the same in the same part of our feet. And we also, Si and I were both wearing exactly the same boots. We'd been training in those boots. So we started to say, I wonder if it's a rub from that particular type of boot. It's an Innovate Mudclaw, brilliant boot, which I would use again, by the way. And it turns out it wasn't the boot. And in the morning, Hugh then, as the kind of the team's most proficient and current medic, was looking at our feet and like in disgust.
Oh, I was worried. I was properly worried. I was really worried at that point.
And this was, I would say this is the kind of, the biggest, if I ever talk about this to anyone in a kind of like a lessons learned and inspirational, whatever kind of thing, it was my biggest challenge as the person who kind of convened this team. I wouldn't say a team leader, but I knew that I'd brought this together. I'd made this happen and it was kind of my fault. So when we were sitting there in the morning and Si, who's, they're all dear friends of mine, but I've done a lot of these with Si. And he's older than me, I'd like to point out. Good, but we're definitely the two old blokes on the team. But he's significantly fitter than me. He's stronger, he's faster, he's fitter. And I was devastated because it looked like he might not be able to do the second leg, you know, the leg back, because his feet, not because he felt he couldn't physically, but between the medical advice of Hugh that we respected and Si's professionalism, not wanting to put the team at risk, and one of our guides, Gibson, saying, I don't think you should go back out into the hill with that. And we knew that although it's a rash at this point, if he kind of developed some kind of sepsis, or we weren't 100% sure in the team's ability to communicate and call, you know, external help in. We were insured, but we weren't sure that we could communicate.
Well, there's nowhere for it to land, though. That was my worry. There was nowhere for a helicopter to land because there was a few LZs sort of landing zones in the villages. But Si, yeah, Si's a big, muscly guy, you know, carrying Si 10 miles across that horrendous track, you know.
Yeah.
No, I'll never forget that moment coming into Kokoda Village, which is the halfway point, because it's the finish point for a lot of people. And I don't get emotional on trips that often, but I remember getting in, getting my mosquito net up, getting my sleeping bag out and just sort of going on my hands and knees and getting really emotional. And I think the emotion came from being relieved to be at the halfway point, but then knowing the full horror of what we've got to do. And there was no lying to myself, because with a lot of these expeditions, I just lied to myself. I wake up at sort of 5 a.m. I think, what have I got to do? Right, lie to yourself. Oh, it'll be fine. It'll be sunny 25K a day. What can be so hard about 25K a day? Yeah, it'll be fine. Back to sleep. But of course, I was at the point now where there was no lying to myself, because I knew exactly what was coming.
Yeah.
My feet were pretty bad. And I remember being on hands and knees, and there was very little food on that halfway point, because only a very few, very skeleton crew of the guides had come down. There was hardly any food, and I remember thinking, I just got to eat something. So I had a bowl of like pasta, watery pasta with Ritz crackers thrown into it, and you know, I remember sort of forcing that down me, and all the honey roast peanuts that I had left, and I was thinking, right, you've got to pull yourself together. And then I looked over and saw Si's foot, and it immediately snapped me out of it, and I was like, wow, right, back in the room, Si, your feet, what is going on there? And I remember shining a torch on him thinking, what is going on here? And, you know, as Jay said, in hindsight now, trench foot, I would say. But, you know, we're all experienced in the outdoors, and it just caught us, didn't it? It just caught us off guard. And we had been doing foot care. We had been taking our shoes out. We'd been drying them. With all of that, it still managed to catch up on us. And, you know, Si was literally, it was like walking on crushed glass. He said every step he took, it was agony. And he's a big, strong, tough guy, Si. You know, he's no shrinking violet. And the look of worry on his face, my face, and Gibson's face, sort of, we said, oh, we'll see how they are in the morning. And I was thinking, if he gets sepsis in that jungle and he's 10 miles from a landing zone, we are going to struggle getting him you know, to the, that was my biggest worry. And I, you know, I still stand by that now. You know, it was, is this a stupid thing to do?
So
getting him back into that jungle.
And this is my dilemma, because on the way out, on the way out to the turnaround point, that first 4 days, the villagers, it, like Hugh says, it was tough. I never doubt. I always believe we can do these things. And I probably believe in the team more than I believe in myself, to be fair. But I never doubt that. And along the way, even the villagers, as we went through the villages and our guides were talking to them in the kind of local dialect, one of the many dialects there are, the villagers were like, well, you're not going to achieve that. And we said, we'll see you on the way back. And they're like, no, you won't. You won't come back. They did not believe us, even the villagers. And I remember one of the team saying to me, Jay, they don't think we're going to make it. And I said, that's because they don't know us. They think we're like everyone else, but we're not. And you know we're not. And you know we're going to make this. And I remember that incident, episode, if you like. And then when we got to a turnaround point and Sai's going to take one for the team, Sai says, I'm not going to come back on the second leg because I can't jeopardize the team. The team's more important. And I'm heartbroken for Sai. And I know that he wants to come, but I know that he's putting the team first. And then I'm thinking, well, my feet are only one grade back from his feet. So should I be doing the same thing for the team? Maybe I should step out. Because how can I apply one standard to Sai and a different standard to me? But then I think, equally, if I do step out, will the team carry on? And so I'm suddenly, you know, what do I do? And then circumstances changed a couple of times. And then Sai was going to come and then he wasn't going to come again. And then he went to get the plane that was going to take him out and the plane wouldn't let him on for whatever reason. And then he came back and he said, and I won't swear on this podcast, but he's like, blah, blah, blah. I'm coming. Get me my bag. And he was back in. And I like cuddled him and I was over the moon. And then as we set off, I'm thinking, oh, we're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
You know,
and it was, wasn't it? It was that trek out of the village and there were people sort of come to see us off because they kind of knew what we were doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of our minds were thinking, we know what's coming. Is this the right thing to do? And Sai sort of came up behind us because they wouldn't let him on the plane. And he sat down, he said, I've just got to compede my feet. So compede, if you don't have them in the US, they're like the sort of the sticky rubber plastery things. And, you know, we'd had a few each, we'd had a ration of them each. And I remember Sai's feet were just completely covered in compede. And I looked at him and I thought, that they're not going to stay on there for 2 minutes. But we covered them in, his whole foot was a compede, bandage on it. And then he got it back in his shoe. And I was thinking, we've got no compete left for the rest of us now. So if we do start to hurt, what are we going to do? And then all of our minds were looking at each other thinking, is this stupid? But we couldn't have got back anyway. So the good thing was the next plane wasn't, this was a Sunday. The next plane out wasn't until the Thursday. And they told us pretty much there and then, there's a fair chance you won't get on it. Certainly five of you won't get on it. So it was a case of, we might be here for, you know, we had other things planned. We had to get back. So it was a kind of case. And I'm quite glad
for
that.
Interview.
That's right, yeah. And, you know, and we had flights booked, so we couldn't have stayed out there for another week waiting for a flight, you know. We had to either get on with it, and it kind of forced our hand, really. And if it had all gone wrong, we would have found a way. I just would have blamed Jay.
You'd beat me up.
But we would have found a way. But it was, you're tired and that anxious mind is eating away at you, saying, right, we've just got to get on with this. And of course, there's no lying to yourself. You know what's coming. And we knew the days and we knew. And to be brutally honest, as me and Jay were just chatting about this before the call, we were faffing about for so long. We were sort of chatting about what to do. We'd wasted half that day chatting about what to do and making a decision. And it wasn't an easy decision to make because we were trying to get antibiotics, which just didn't come. We were trying to get a flight out of this tiny village that that didn't end up materializing. And, you know, we'd wasted then, it's about 11 o'clock and we were meant to start off at about 6. We were starting off about 5:30 most days. We lost half a day. So we knew now we were going to be, it was like that feeling at the end of the first night where we think, oh, and why, you know, we've lost half a day. We haven't done enough. We're not going to do enough today. Where are we going to stay tonight? And then we cracked on till really late that night. And I think we thought, well, we're invested now. We've got to do it. And so be it.
In the bottom of my heart, I knew we'd do it. And as we were coming back along the villages, you could then see the locals starting to believe. And not only the ones we were passing, but the ones we were coming to were beginning. And by the time we'd get to villages or we'd get to groups of people, they'd be like, are you the ones going there and back? And the story, whereas on the way out, the story had been, those guys are never going to make it. On the way back, the legend had already built on the track in the time we're walking there and saying, there's a bunch of guys that are doing it there and back in 8 days. And as we're coming through, the locals and other people on the tours looking at us saying, and like there were Australians there, weren't there? There was a bunch of Brits there. And they were like, are you the ones doing it there and back? And the kind of legend had already built, even within that, even within the time on the way back.
And we were chatting, people were more chatty, weren't they, then, once they sort of, you know, we got conversation, you know, with people and people. Yeah, it was, I think it got easier then. Every day that it went on, it just did seem to sort of, the pressure did start to relieve, because I think, right, but you still know what you got to do. And there's, you know, we still knew the track, but it was nice. I started to believe once we'd left Kokoda, I did start to believe myself, but it took a while. It really did. It took a while.
So I assume Sai made it. You all made it. We all back. Made it.
Yep. Everyone did it.
And was there any additional illness or injury? Was the trench foot kind of the main thing?
Yeah, I remember on day one, we were full of energy. We were full of excitement. And we got about 10K in. And there was a chap coming the other way. And he said, oh, it's my first day. I can't do it. I was sick in the night, and he looked quite a fit lad. And I was thinking, he's only going one way in 8 days. We're going both ways in 8 days, and he's already given up on day one. What are we letting ourselves in for? And I did remember start to think, perhaps you know, this is the sort of thing. And I was carrying a bit of a knee injury, not before that. I thought it had gone. It's basically I'm fine up, but going downhill, what happens is it's a bit like sort of getting a knife stabbed in my leg, and then it just collapses on itself. So the number of times, hence why we're so covered in mud, was anything steep where you've got to steady yourself, my knee would just give way. And it was like, and I did have a few tantrums, and it was a regret now. And I think back and I think, oh, what an absolute mess I must have been, sort of slapping the mud because I was so covered in mud. And, you know, and it was instant. So it would just go, and then I just barreled down a hill. And then it was one point, I think it was something like day 6, and I slipped, fell down the back, and then I fell down the side, probably about 5 meters off the side of this edge. And I was clinging on to this tree, and the boys were shouting at the top, and I was thinking, what is down there? What is up there? So I was hanging on and thinking, I've got to get back up there now. So all of a sudden, this walking pole sort of start extending down. And I was thinking, what have I done? This knee is, I'm never coming back from this. This knee injury is with me for the rest of my life now until I have some sort of surgery. But yeah, you know, when I go back, it was all right again, but it was that sort of instant.
You did Kilimanjaro about 2 weeks later, didn't you?
Yeah, well, do you know, and it was, I was working on the Kilimanjaro trip the 2 weeks after, and I was, all that was going through my mind at one point, because my feet started to get bad and my knee was bad, and I was thinking, oh, I'm going to have to let my company down now and say, I'm not going to be able to lead that trip. I'm not going to be able to walk. And I was like, Jay, when I got back into the hotel, my feet started to be really bad. My knee was really swollen. And I was thinking, oh, I'm going to let people down now. You know, have I pushed it too far? Have I pushed it too hard? And yeah, I got back and I couldn't walk. I was on the plane on the way back thinking, oh, you know, I'm in an absolute state. My knee was double the size. But, you know, the body heals. Even, you know, I'm a guy in my 40s, you know, it does heal. You just got to give it a bit of rest. And then, yeah, 2 weeks later, I was, yeah, shooting off to Killy to take a group up. And I was still walking a little bit funny. But, I was worried that I was going to let people down. And I think there is an element of that where you think, oh, is this daft? And that runs through my head a lot. Is this daft or is this dangerous? And will I be criticized by, you know, all and sundry if I die on this for, you know, doing something stupid? But we survived, so it's all right.
We made it. When we got back, there's probably two parts about when we got back into Port Moresby. The first kind of day of proper rest in the hotel, we had a young reporter came along and did a kind of an impromptu interview with him, which then went got taken back onto the national news. So the national news ran a piece that these foreign trekkers have come in, broken the Kokoda track record. And that formed a part of our kind of information piece to people back here to say what we've done, almost verification that it was really something that had never been done. You know, we made the national news. That's the proof that it's never been done before. And that's what they said about it. And it was significant enough of an achievement that the national news chose to run it. So that was kind of vindication, really. And then we also went to visit a local rugby team to give them a bit of a speech, because our guy Tuller used to play for the local team, like a semi-pro rugby team. And he took us there to give a bit of motivation to the team, to say, he asked us to talk about resilience and kind of keep going when, because they couldn't believe that we were still walking on our ridiculous feet. they're like, how are you still doing that? They couldn't believe that we kept going, and we kept going at the pace without, you know, unerring pace. They couldn't believe it. So they kind of asked us to go and talk to this local team who incidentally won the following week against the odds. And the final piece was we, I guess the governor of Oro Province, which is the first half of the track sits in Oro Province. We also met him. He came to talk to us to kind of say, you know, thanks for doing it, bringing attention to it, and kind of congratulating us for the achievement and doing it. Because what one of the beautiful parts about the whole thing was the local communities who have their own issues. And we tried to steer clear of the politics a little bit, but there's issues about land ownership and rights across the track, and the fact that the track is kept in kind of 1942 conditions to satisfy a tourist market, which is, you know, justifiably recognizing wartime heroics, but at the cost of development of the local community. So the community cannot develop, cannot modernize, because that would detract from the attraction of the track, the historic attraction. So there's a bit of politics around that. But anyway, we met the governor, but what was beautiful about that track, for its simplicity, you know, each village has one mobile phone charger that the villagers share. And when you go through it, the kids are playing in bushes and rolling tires around. They have next to no electricity, next to no resources, and yet they're all happy. And they were coming up to us and taking pictures and
playing rugby,
interacting with us.
We're playing rugby.
Playing rugby. Point. They're massively into rugby, into rugby league.
Yeah.
It was really interesting, simple, the nature, the sounds at night. So we're setting off by head torch and finishing by head torch. And we had it, what do we call that alley? I can't remember, but it was
the cicadas. Oh, I can still remember that now.
And the Beatles, yeah. The noise as the dusk sets, the jungle comes to life. And they're like communicating with each other. And as we're going through this wall of sound, because the whatever creatures are in the trees are communicating to each other, saying, they're coming through you. It was like being a part of it, being a part of the jungle. It was amazing. Beautiful.
Yeah. I think for me as well, like with the connection we made with guides, with the sort of the ground crew there, with you know, Tala and with Fred. I mean, I spent a lot of time with Fred. I had a really strong connection with him, and you know, we got on really, really well. And you know, his sort of 1 hour, and you know, I people have lost it with me as a trip leader, and I lost it with him at one point, and I said, "Come off it, Fred." And I really snapped at him, and I sort of gathered my thoughts in the camp, and I went, "I'm really sorry, that was out of order. I'm just desperate to get back to the break point." And he sort of gave me a hug, and it was really strong connections with them, and we did it all as a team. And you know, they were like part of the family. I mean, you know, that sort of connections that we built was, yeah. And we went to see, you know, Fred's Village, and we stayed in Fred's Village, and yeah, it was just brilliant. It was the I think the thing about doing these things really quick, anything you do, we did it with the Pyrenees, where we raced to do it as quickly as we possibly can. You do miss out a little bit, you know. It's a little bit like, you know, the cyclists on the Tour de France, where they don't get to see any of France. And I did wonder whether we didn't have time to take the beauty, and we didn't have time to enjoy the villages, because we were getting in the dark. We were forcing as much food as we could down our necks, and then we were trying to sleep. And I didn't have a problem sleeping after that first night, but it was literally, you just kind of missed an awful lot. And, you know, we were talking about whether we could do it quicker if we ever went back. And we said we probably, if conditions were different, we probably could do it a bit quicker now, knowing what we know now, kit selection, you know, what we would wear, what we'd take. And if the ground was drier, whether it ever gets dry, you know, could we do it quicker? We probably could. But would we be missing out on a lot of beautiful stuff then, a lot of things that we perhaps missed on that first time? Because you know, I say to this to clients all the time, look up, enjoy it, you know, take it in. Don't just wish your life away. And a lot of people on, like Killy, you know, they were literally wishing the week away. I said, you'll be back in work next week. Take it in now, enjoy it as hard as it is. And, you know, that was probably one of my biggest regrets on that, is that I was so focused on goal focused. Perhaps I didn't take in as much as the beauty that perhaps we should have at the time.
Well, thank you both so much for coming on the show today. It sounds like an incredible adventure, and I really appreciate you sharing about it.
No, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. And actually, it's been quite nice to revisit it, really, just by talking to you about it. Yeah, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks again, Justin and Hugh, for coming on the show. You can read about their FKT on the website, fastestknowntime.com, and learn more about Brecon Mountain Rescue Team at breconmrt.co.uk.